I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the Pentagon said three more brigades, over 10,000 American troops, will head to Afghanistan next spring, while reporter Sebastian Younger says they're desperately needed. We'll speak with him in a few minutes. But first, the Bush administration proposed Wall Street bailout hit some speed bumps in Congress today. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke went before the Senate Banking Committee saying without a bailout, there will be a worldwide credit crisis. But the ranking Republican, Richard Shelby of Alabama, who said today's hearings may be the most momentous in decades, said the bailout plan would do nothing to address the root cause, the rising default rate on mortgages.
I believe the absence of a clear and comprehensive plan for addressing this crisis has injected additional uncertainty into our markets and has undetermined the ability of our markets to tackle this crisis on their own. Unfortunately, the Treasury Department's latest proposal continues, I believe, its ad hoc approach, but on a much grander scale.
And John Tester, Democrat from Montana, summed it up this way.
You guys are a lot smarter in financials than I am. I'm a dirt farmer. Why do we have 1 week to determine $700 billion that has to be appropriated or this country's financial systems go down the pipes? Wasn't there some opportunity sometime down the line where we could have been informed of how serious this crisis was so we could take some preventative steps before this got to this point?
Maura Reynolds is covering the story for the Los Angeles Times. Maura, help us out here because we're reading reports that lawmakers in the Treasury have agreed in principle on some oversight of the bailout and some help for homeowners. But is any of that in stone? What's going on?
No, the situation is very, very fluid. There are negotiations going on over various ways that the, you know, larger issues could be resolved, but no one's signed off on this yet. And if, you know, listening to the hearing this morning, both Democrats and Republicans have a huge amount of skepticism about all of the ideas being presented. So I think we're in for a rollicking week here.
Now, some are comparing this to the entry to the war in Iraq, that there wasn't enough attention paid to weapons of mass destruction or allegations of weapons of mass destruction, and they're being more cautious now. But what did Fed Chair Ben Bernanke say about how the bailout might work? Did he say what kind of debt the government would buy up?
You know, they're not even at that point yet in many ways. They are still trying to convince Congress that some kind of a massive rescue plan is what is needed. The details of how that's going to work are, you know, they're, like I said, they're still fluid. But right now, there are a lot of Democrats, there's a lot of Republicans who aren't even sure that something as massive as a $700 billion rescue plan is really what's needed.
Well, we know that there were closed doors meetings over the weekend that we were told, some of the lawmakers were told what would happen if there wasn't a bailout, and they sat in stunned silence. Are we hearing any of that today from either?
We are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, they're trying to underscore, and you know, Henry Paulson, who's a kind of cut-and-dried figure most of the time and reads his prepared remarks exactly as they're written, went off on large ad-libs today when he was addressing the panel, and he said, this is all about the taxpayer. That is all we care about. He's trying to make the case that while it looks like you're helping out Wall Street, that this is actually something that's going to hit the pocketbooks of pretty much every American homeowner and taxpayer.
In fact, Republican Mike Enzi of Wyoming said the plan would cost every American $2,300, but more if nothing is done. Well, later in the program today, we're going to talk about a call for a cap on executive pay and freeing up judges so that they can renegotiate failing mortgages. But we've read that one provision would allow the government to hire private companies to manage assets that are bought up. And has there been any talk about that? Does that mean private contractors, or have they not gotten to that?
I think the problem there is that, you know, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department aren't really in the asset buying and selling business very much. And when they have to get out of their expertise, they often will hire outside people. For instance, if you remember, the Treasury Department hired Morgan Stanley to help them figure out the situation around Fannie and Freddie this summer. So, you know, I think Paulson wants the freedom to be able to bring in expertise, you know, people who are good at evaluating assets and disposing of them and evaluating risk. The problem is a lot of those same people are the same people who have been working on Wall Street. And I can imagine that a lot of Democrats anyway are going to say, why are we hiring the same people who caused this financial mess in the first place?
Yeah. So pretty contentious day. It seems as if, as we said, this is a speed bump. Maura Reynolds of the Los Angeles time speaking to us from Washington. We'll just keep our ear to the ground as it all gets as it all shakes out. Maura, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates says that up to three more combat brigades could be available to go to Afghanistan beginning next spring. That's an answer to repeated calls from commanders for more troops. But what is actually happening on the ground in Afghanistan? For 15 months, the Men of Battle Company from the Army's 2nd Battalion of the 503rd Infantry fought to secure the Kornagal Valley from the Taliban. But when they left this summer, it was pretty much a draw. Journalist Sebastian Younger has been documenting their fight. His latest story appears in the October issue of Vanity Fair. By the way, you can read it at our website, here-now.org. And Sebastian joins us from the Argo Network Studios in New York with more. Sebastian, welcome back Here Now.
Thank you.
And your story this time is called Return to the Valley of Death, the Kornagal Valley. Put it on the map for us and put it in context, because you write some military planners say the fighting in this valley is a test case for how to fight an insurgency.
The Kornagal Valley is about 6 miles long, and it's in Kunar province of eastern Afghanistan. Kunar is known, its reputation as being one of the most hardcore places in Afghanistan. It's very mountainous, and the Soviets had a very hard time there. For that matter, the Taliban had a hard time there taking it over. They failed ultimately, and now the Americans are having great difficulty. It's seen as a test case for how to fight an insurgency for two reasons. One is it's right near the border with Pakistan, and a lot of weapons and fighters come over the border into the Kornagal to fight the Americans there. But also, you have several villages, you have one small valley, and the thinking seems to be, if we can get it right in this valley, which is so hardcore militant, maybe we can spread the same process throughout Afghanistan in general.
Well, and U.S. forces have been trying to do that by setting up smaller outposts rather than living sequestered out on big bases. This is General Petraeus' thinking that he tried to enact in Iraq. But that's also set troops up for some of the deadliest fighting in this war. You describe the Taliban assault on one small American base in the town of Wanat in July. You write that the Taliban fighters filtered into the town. They tell the locals to leave. Then they set up fighting positions in deserted homes. And then what happened?
Well, a massive attack started at dawn, and nine American soldiers were killed. And the attackers managed to breach the wire. They got inside the concertina wire at an observation post.
But as you write, let's just remind ourselves, it was concertina wire and some Humvees lumped together. I mean, that's it, protecting these guys.
That's right. It was a temporary base. Since the attack, they abandoned the base. The positions I was at were smaller positions. Wanat had almost 50 American soldiers. I was at outposts that had 10 or 15 American soldiers, but they were protected by sandbags and bunkers.
Well, and in Wanat, a four-hour fight, and, you know, attackers literally feet from troops, nine Americans from Chosen Company in Wanat were killed, 21 wounded. Pretty much everyone suffering a casualty. What's the thinking about, wait a second, maybe we won't be able to do this, have these small outposts, if they're just going to get overrun?
Well, that's the thing about the war, is that every solution you come up with to a problem, it might solve that problem, but it presents another difficulty. So if you stay on big bases, for the American military, if they stay on big bases, they don't get to interact with the locals. That interaction is key to winning the hearts and minds of the populace, and that's key to beating the insurgency. So you have to have small bases, but if you have small bases, of course, you're in danger of being overrun. As I said, the position that I was at had 15 men. I think pretty much everyone there realized that if they were attacked by enough guys, they would be overrun, everyone would get killed. I think that was sort of the working assumption among the men at that outpost. And it was an idea that absolutely terrified me. And my fear is that with all these small outposts, they are necessary. Strategically, they're necessary. But tactically, they're very vulnerable. And my fear is that eventually they're going to overrun a base.
Well, you were attacked when you were visiting with Battle Company. And, it just suddenly, as you wrote, somebody's brushing their teeth and doesn't even have time to spit, you know, before he has a machine gun in his hands, one of the troops there, because it happens that suddenly, and then they just go away if they can't breach the outpost.
That's right. The attacks come very, very suddenly. Not once did it happen when I was expecting it. But these guys, you know, the Americans, they know how to fight very, very well. They're in bunkers, and it would take a huge force to overrun a position like Restrepo, where I was in that particular firefight. But they were attacked all the time. I mean, there were times when they would be attacked two or three times a day. They got pretty used to it.
Well, and as you said, the hope is that they can appeal to the hearts and minds of Afghans, and they have in many cases started tipping off the Americans to where the Taliban are. But is that working, Sebastian?
It does work at times. On several occasions, I was in a situation where I was watching locals give up very valuable information to the Americans, and seemingly with some enthusiasm. I mean, a lot of the locals are really sick of the fighting and sick of the Taliban, and the Taliban, they're essentially, they act a little bit like bullies in the valley, and they'll beat people up and they'll punish them for shaving their beards, for example, and the locals are sick of it. So they'll give these guys up, but they also do it at great risk to themselves. And if the Taliban know that someone's passed on their names or their locations, that person would be killed. So it's a very delicate game in the valley.
We spoke to Mark Alasco recently. He's a former Pentagon missile targeter who now is a member of Human Rights Watch. And he has a huge concern that there's just not enough boots on the ground in Afghanistan and elsewhere because of the surge in insurgents. We're hearing talk, you know, today from the Pentagon about more troops heading to Afghanistan. Do you think that's part of the problem? I mean, if it's going to be still a small number of troops in outposts, will it help that there are more outposts?
Well, I think it can't help but help the problem to have more men there. I mean, the Russians had 100,000, over 100,000 men. It didn't work, but their entire strategy was deeply flawed. I think the American strategy is good. But they have fewer soldiers in Afghanistan than they have police in New York City. I mean, it's just not enough guys for a country of that size. My concern wouldn't be so much adding more outposts, but making sure the outposts that do exist are adequately manned. The 15 men that I was with at some of these positions, in a big enough assault, they would not be able to hold the position, and that would be a disaster for American policy.
Well, and some of the men that you were with didn't feel they were in the right country. I mean, talk about the fighters who are coming over the border from Pakistan and how some American troops feel that's where they should be.
Well, the Americans could listen in on the Taliban radio frequencies, and the Afghan translators who worked with the Americans said that they heard Pakistani all the time. There are Pakistani names, Arabic names. All of these people are coming across the border from Pakistan. And the weapons and the ammunition shipments all come from Pakistan. You could hear the commanders talking about how they're waiting for more ammunition to come from Pakistan. I mean, the name Pakistan came up over and over and over again. The soldiers know this. So when they're getting shot at, you know, with bullets that came across the border from a neighboring country that supposedly is an ally of the United States. And that really outrages these soldiers. I don't mean the officers. And so when you ask these guys about, are they going to stay in the military or whatever, a lot of them can't wait to get out. But many of them will say, if we could just go into Pakistan and solve this problem, that's where the problem is. If we could invade Pakistan, I would re-up just so that we could do that.
And of course, there are reports that Pakistan, again, recently fired at U.S. helicopters they claimed were flying over Pakistan. Sebastian Younger's story about the fight for the Karangal Valley in Afghanistan appears in the October issue of Vanity Fair. When we come back, how war changed the men of Battle Company and they changed the war. And later, should we cut CEO pay in the bailout? Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from journalist Sebastian Younger. His story about battle companies fight for the Karangal Valley in northeast Afghanistan, about 15 men against hordes of Taliban and other insurgents, appears in the October issue of Vanity Fair magazine. Before the break, we were talking about how Afghanistan is a safe haven for the Taliban moving in and out of Afghanistan. But, Sebastian, what's your sense of who these fighters are? There are reports today in the New York Times about fighting in the Bahar border area in Pakistan, U.S. officials saying that fighting there is going to determine the fate of other tribal areas, and that U.S. officials are stunned at how well-armed and trained these fighters are.
The fighters that the Americans were fighting in the Karangal Valley were extremely good. I think tactically they were probably about as good as the Americans. But they don't have air power, and you know the problem with all this is if you have a minimal amount of troops in an area, A patrol goes out, they get ambushed, they take 50% casualties. The reaction by the U.S. military, understandably, is to rush in and save their guys. So they have to do that with air power. Air power is imprecise, and it ends up killing civilians. If there were more men in these valleys, say instead of a company of soldiers, 150 men in the Korongal Valley, suppose you had a battalion, then there wouldn't even be a fight there.
And because a battalion is how many?
A battalion is around 500 men.
Mm-hmm.
Then there wouldn't even be a fight there. The insurgents couldn't even attempt to tackle a battalion in the Korongal. So you wouldn't have to call in air power all the time. So you wouldn't kill civilians. So the war would go a lot better. It's this sort of snowball effect that comes from ultimately not having enough men on the ground in Afghanistan.
Well, and the Pentagon is talking about sending 3 new brigades to Afghanistan as early as this spring. But who is arming these Arabs, Chechens, Uzbeks, in addition to the Taliban, these fighters that are crossing over from Pakistan getting paid $200, who's arming them?
I mean, look, the world is awash in weapons, and that part of the world is particularly awash in weapons. And there are towns in Pakistan that manufacture AK-47s from scratch. I mean, if you want to buy an AK-47 and some ammunition, it's not that hard. I don't think there's a state sponsor that's necessarily arming them per se, but Pakistan at the very least is turning a blind eye towards the insurgents' very successful attempts to buy arms and ammunition. They're turning a blind eye to it, and you know, in some cases, some fairly significant weapon systems are getting across the border: mortars, 82-millimeter recoilless rifles, very, very dangerous stuff that can, frankly, they can kill a lot of people.
Well, I want to talk about the men of Battle Company, the men that you stayed with in Afghanistan who came home in August. You write that war has changed these men, but you also ask if they've changed the war. Let's take the first part. War has changed these men. How so?
War always changes people.
Sure.
It changed me. I was there on five different occasions over the course of a year. A couple of things happen. I mean, on the one hand, you get very jumpy about things. I mean, literally jumpy. You're walking down the street, something goes bang, and you don't jump, you crouch is actually more specifically what you do. These guys, I didn't experience this, but these guys said that their temper is a lot worse. When they go home on leave, they were very, very tightly wound. And the third component that's less talked about, but is this sort of addiction to combat. Combat is very, very intense. It's exciting. I mean, it's also scary. It's a lot of things, but it's very exciting. And these guys do get addicted to it, and I even found that a little bit in myself. And some of them were actually, frankly, worried that their experience in combat was so intense that when they went back to civilian life, that they would actually miss it, and that things in civilian life would become a paler version of combat, and that it wouldn't feel like real life, and that they would not be interested in their lives back home. And that was, among some of the men, that was a real concern. They seemed to get addicted to it in the way teenagers can get addicted to video games.
You know, we hear that, and of course, as you've said, of course we know war impacts men and women. But we're hearing today that in the Bush administration assessment of Afghanistan, they're talking about military campaign plans for the next 5 to 10 years. I mean, troops may be going back quite a bit.
I don't really see the situation changing rapidly in Afghanistan. You have to remember that these people it's very different from Vietnam. They all volunteered. They all wanted to be soldiers. And the guys in the combat units, and it really is all men in these combat units, they had to try out for these units, almost like making the varsity football team. This is something they actively wanted to do. And so that, when I was over there and would talk about their circumstances with them, the one thing that was missing that I think probably was not true in the Vietnam War was that there was very little griping about sort of their lot in life. They chose this job, and for a lot of them, with a great degree of enthusiasm, they wanted to experience combat. So I think that actually helps them go back over and over again, because they do have the option of getting out of the military, and many of them are not choosing that. This is the lifestyle they chose. I do think that helps, but let's face it, it's a ghastly, very, very difficult job, and I certainly don't envy those guys.
But how have they changed this war?
A company of American soldiers over the course of a year pushed the sort of frontier of American influence about a mile south in one valley. Unfortunately, the bottom part of the valley, the last third, of the valley is a haven of insurgents, a beehive of Taliban activity. And if the Americans went down there, they would just get hammered by attacks.
Sebastian, you've made so many trips now. Outside of your affection for these men that you are covering and have gotten to know, and the importance of Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden still on the border with Pakistan, such a key area, why should we care about Afghanistan?
I think any country in armed chaos needs to be dealt with by the international community and dealt with militarily if need be. Somalia is another example. But specifically for Americans, that is where 9/11 happened. And I think in terms of the memory of the people we lost and in terms of preventing something like that from happening again, we have to secure Afghanistan in some kind of reasonable way, or this stuff is just going to keep repeating itself and more people will die.
Sebastian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Sebastian Younger's latest article about Afghanistan appears in the October issue of Vanity Fair. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, as we heard, a prolonged war in Afghanistan, a war in Iraq, a huge deficit, a crisis in the economy. You'd think the challenger to the ruling Republican Party would be far ahead in the polls, but he's not. It could be because of the strength of John McCain, but is it also because race is more of a factor than people want to admit? Take a look at that tomorrow, Here and Now. Still ahead, adjusting mortgages after the news.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical, usable legal advice for more than 100 years, in Boston and on the web at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, executive pay on Wall Street. Some firms spend nearly half their earnings on salaries, and one analyst says that has to change.
You cannot run a business if you're going to give half of your profits to the executives. The only way you can do that is to make reckless bets. When the bets pay out, you're fine. When the bets don't pay out, you're in the soup.
Also, remembering the genius of the late pianist Glenn Gould. Coming up, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we reported earlier today about how Congress and the Bush administration are wrangling over a $700 billion bailout plan for financial firms. One question being raised, how much executives at these firms get paid? Many lawmakers want to limit the amount of money CEOs can collect as they walk out the door of failing firms. Our next guest says the government needs to intervene to create a whole new pay structure on Wall Street, or the problem will start all over again. Peter Morici is professor of international business at the University of Maryland. Professor Morici, tell us more about the compensation structure, the whole thing that you say led to this problem on Wall Street.
Essentially, bankers are rewarded on a commission basis for the amount of business they generate. So a banker that, for example, bundles a bunch of shabby subprime loans into bonds and then purportedly insures them by writing credit default swaps, which may prove inadequate, and sells them to bondholders as less risky than they are, gets a big commission. Then 2 years later, when the bonds start failing, and the bank has to perhaps make good on some of the losses. The banker gets to keep his money, but the shareholders take the loss.
Well, do you think that somebody should be punished if that happens, if they sell something just to drive up commissions, and then a couple years down the road it turns out to be absolute junk?
In principle, yes, but that kind of system would be too hard to implement and would not really work. Rather, we just need to simply get bankers' compensation back in line. This sort of an implicit cartel. It's not overt. People aren't getting up in the morning and fixing prices. But among the New York banks, to pay very high sums and then to say, well, we're in a competitive industry. If I don't pay someone a lot at Citigroup, they'll go over to Merrill Lynch and get a lot. The reality is the banks pay more than everyone else for new graduates and for people with limited experience on up through senior executives. You can't hire MBAs and after 3 years' experience pay them $10 million a year. That simply has to change.
Just a little more about the salaries, because you've also said that one problem when you pay a young person just with their MBA $10 million a year, the CEO also has to justify their $200 million salary, and these people feel pressure to do something riskier, not just for their salary, but for the CEOs, for the whole house of cards.
Well, essentially what it does is it permits CEOs to justify very high compensation schemes. If we continue to pay people like Vikram Pandit, for example, $155 million for hoisting a bogus hedge fund on his shareholders, we're just not going to be able to make the banks work. It'd be like paying auto workers $300 an hour and expecting them to make cars that sell.
Well, but a couple questions. First of all, CNBC correspondent Jane Wells asks you something I'm going to ask. You mentioned that, if you don't pay somebody the amount of money, they might go across the street to another investment bank. But what if, the fear and what we were always told about CEO salaries is, well, they'd leave the industry altogether, and that's why we have to pay them.
Well, I think that we could find plenty of people to run these banks from our CEOs that run regional banks. There are plenty of well-run banks in America, and there are plenty of well-run companies in America that don't pay these kinds of salaries. I just think that's a bogus argument.
And what about actually doing this? How do you do it? You legislate it? I mean, this is, or has been until the last couple of weeks, a free market economy.
It is still a free market economy. We've been down this road before when the banks have gotten in trouble. The difference this time is the banks brought the trouble on themselves.
So how do you get salaries down?
Well, you essentially tell the banks that they need to do two things. Securitize good loans from regional banks into bonds. Sell them to fixed income investors like insurance companies and pension funds. And that would generate a reasonable amount of money. And they would have to pay executives out of that. Basically, to participate in the program, they'd have to lower their compensation structure to those in other financial services like insurance companies or related industrial firms.
So in saying that, they should start buying up good mortgages and bundling them and not bundling up junk, are you also saying that they should only be paid if they do well?
I think they should be paid salaries like executives everywhere else and not be put on incentive schemes which encourage them to make very creative, obscure and arcane engineered financial products that come back and bite the industry.
And again, how do you do this? The Bush administration right now is against putting a limit on these golden parachutes, not even the salaries, but, the exit parachutes that executives have. So how do you get them to tamp down these salaries?
Well, if they want to participate in the program, they have to do it. They have to come up with salary structures that make sense. Lehman Brothers was paying better than 49% of its net earnings over the last couple of years to its executives in the forms of salaries and bonuses. You cannot run a business if you're going to give half of your profits to the executives. The only way you can do that is to make reckless bets. When the bets pay out, you're fine. When the bets don't pay out, you're in the soup.
One last question for you, Professor Morisi. There's been a request from housing activists and many Democrats that the average homeowner be given some help through this bailout, that banks be forced to renegotiate some of these loans that are on variable interest rates, for instance, so that the interest rates have shot through the roof. How do you feel about that?
Well, the Treasury or the U.S. taxpayer is going to lose money on this process, unlike the Resolution Trust Corporation during the savings and loan crisis. It won't be able to recoup all the money it loses from foreclosures.
And we talked about this yesterday. One of the things that the savings and loans crisis had going for it is that a lot of the assets that the government took over and then sold were worth a lot of money, like casinos and hotels.
Not only that, housing prices this time have fallen by almost 20%. So the mortgage values are just way in excess of what the housing values are. My feeling is that giving aid and assistance to homeowners would increase the cost of this program. Now, we can make the choice to do that, but I think it should be in separate legislation that provides direct assistance to homeowners, so we have a separate price tag for that.
What do you think of the, I mean, we're hearing already the right-wing radio talking about how this whole bailout is just about, you know, people who don't work and can't speak English, and now we're just, you know, we're become
well,
this huge welfare state.
Well, the bottom line is that everybody's at fault in some measure that was involved in this mess. I mean, how can you have a $60,000 income and buy a $600,000 home and not think that sooner or later you're going to get in trouble? The Wall Street Journal had an example of one couple that refinanced every year for 5 years and drove away from the last closing in a Lexus. They had a modest income. What they were doing is every time the value of the house went up, they got a bigger mortgage to cover their spending. I mean, you got to know that's going to end sooner or later. So there's fault there. And there's fault among the realtors who always have the view that the prices are always going to go up. They can never go down. And you have fault among the mortgage brokers who basically did not document loans properly and knew they weren't doing it properly. We have fault among home appraisers who knew that they were exaggerating values. And you have fault among the, you know, people like Countrywide, what we call, you know, mortgage banking companies. And you have fault at Lehman Brothers and Citigroup. Yeah, all you had to do is go to a cocktail party in Washington to hear stories about crazy mortgages that you knew were never going to be paid.
Well, we should say that a lot of there were predatory lenders, too, I mean, who were preying on people didn't understand.
It's easy to sort of cling on to that. And then it just becomes down to, well, we'll get rid of the predatory lenders. We've got to get rid of predatory lenders. But it was much more fundamental than that. This was an hysteria that gripped normal people that should know better. I don't believe that the people working at Citigroup were raised badly by their parents, that they went there with inherently bad values. They have been whipped up into a culture of entitlement. You know, I don't believe that America is full of bad people. This was so far-reaching, the only way you could conclude that you have to do something about bad people is to say Americans are bad people because so many people were involved. I think that we got involved in a national housing and credit hysteria.
That's economist Peter Morici, professor of international business at the University of Maryland. Thank you so much for speaking with us, professor.
You're welcome.
And as always, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the bailout or anything on the program? Our email address, letters@here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, whether it's because home buyers scammed a banking system more than happy to sell them a bad mortgage or predatory lenders sold bad mortgages to unwitting home buyers, 9,800 homeowners a day are foreclosing. That's 9,800. Both parties are asking for relief for homeowners. And yesterday, leaders from the National Community Reinvestment Coalition met with Fed Chair Ben Bernanke to ask for help for homeowners facing foreclosure. Nadine Cohen is an attorney with Greater Boston Legal Services. She was at that meeting. And Nadine, I know you requested the meeting a while back. Who does the coalition represent?
Well, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition is an association of more than 600 community-based organizations whose goal is to expand financial access for working families and communities. And people were represented from communities all over the country.
Well, as you know, Nadine, the idea of expanding financial access, specifically for, you know, lower-income families, is what some people are saying is part of this problem, that there was too much access for maybe people who couldn't afford it.
Well, I have to say that I have heard those, and we spoke with Chairman Bernanke about that, and he agreed with us that it was not the Community Reinvestment Act or the lending to low-income homeowners that caused the problem. It really is the lack of regulation of the mortgage companies and the securitization of these loans on Wall Street. I represent low-income homeowners who are facing foreclosure, and my clients did not go to lenders and say, please give me a subprime loan with, a balloon payment and please securitize it on Wall Street. My clients were targeted by unscrupulous lenders and Wall Street bought those loans and made money from it.
What are some of the tangible things you'd like to see lenders asked to do?
there has to be meaningful, widespread modification of these loans. We can't do it on an individual basis. There are not enough resources on either the part of the lenders or the advocates to do individual modifications. There has to be some broader base modification that meets the value of what the home is worth today and that takes into account the ability of people to repay. You know, if we took that $700 billion and gave it to the people to pay up their mortgages and rewrote those mortgages that are to make them affordable, we wouldn't have any crisis anymore.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, there are homes that are now mortgaged at, let's say, $500,000 that are only worth $200,000. You can't
exactly.
even sell them. You're saying perhaps level that out. But you know what people are saying who are paying their mortgages. Wait a second. I'm paying my mortgage. I'm fulfilling my obligation. Why should somebody else get off with having theirs reduced?
Well, I think if the real facts got out that people were targeted for these high-cost mortgages that they could not afford, I have clients who are Spanish-speaking, who speak Haitian Creole, who had no understanding of the mortgage markets and these products, and they were targeted for loans they couldn't afford. Mortgage brokers made money off them. Lenders made money off them. The loans were sold. Nobody cared what would happen to the ultimate homeowner, and it was all based on the fact that housing prices were supposed to go up. Well, when the bubble burst, the people left holding the bag are the low-income homeowners. And I think one other important thing we need to do is provide bankruptcy protections for homeowners. Right now, in bankruptcy, a judge does not have the authority to modify a loan on your principal residence. They could modify a loan on your vacation home. They could modify a loan on your boat, but not on your primary residence. And we need bankruptcy protection so that these loans can be modified and people can continue to live in their house and afford their mortgages. People don't want to get out and live rent-free.
And if the mortgages were modified, the thinking is that at least the banks would get something instead of nothing, which they're getting right now.
Absolutely.
That's Nadine Cohen of Greater Boston Legal Services. Nadine, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, we're going to take a minute break and then come back to the beauty of the music of Glenn Gould. That's in 1 minute, here and now. I still have two favorite records. You know that round vinyl thing with a hole in the middle? One is Joni Mitchell, the other, Glenn Gould's Goldberg Variations. That's the aria from Bach's The Goldberg Variations, as performed by the late pianist Glenn Gould in 1955. Why do I keep it? Well, some sort of talisman, I guess, but that's nothing. There's a woman who has tattooed the opening bars of Gould's string quartet all over her body. Why is Gould, who died of a stroke at 50 in 1982 and stopped performing live at the age of 31, still so revered and so puzzling? There's a recently released 80-CD set of his recording, a book of his essays, another about his piano tuner. You can download his quirky radio interviews.
The life of a glamorous concert artist
is hideous, is dead, is part of the past. I think that that has no relevance to the contemporary musical scene. I don't think it even has very much relevance to the contemporary scene as regards performing music.
Yes, Gould was something of a troubled James Dean of the Steinway, but that wouldn't be enough to secure him a place in the great pianist pantheons. What is it? Well, Boston Globe classical music critic Jeremy Eichler might know. Jeremy, a woman, as we said, has tattooed some of Gould's music on her body. Tell us more.
Yes, she was one of these seekers who found in Gould something special enough that she wanted it with her all the time.
This was music he had written, but he wasn't known as a composer. He was known as an interpreter. You write, it was Gould's exploration of Bach's keyboard pieces that was the most revelatory. What do you mean by that?
I think that he was, his whole life, in a way, a frustrated composer. He loved nothing more than going into a recording studio with 10, even 20 different ways of playing the same piece by Bach and just putting them all down and having the chance to figure out which one worked the best. There is a way in which I think recording for him was almost a process of recomposition. And in that sense, I think that he lives on more profoundly than a lot of interpreters do, because many of them take the more popular sort of self-effacing posture, and they think they should only be the faithful servant of the piece. For Gould, it was about getting inside of the music and joining hands with the creator and bringing it to life.
Well, you say he had an iconoclastic brilliance and that he liked to smash icons. He didn't care what the composer thought. But he also smashed his own icon. He recorded the Goldberg Variations twice, once in 1955 and again in 1981 before he died. We heard a little of the 55 version. Let's hear some of the 1981 version of that aria. So there was this brilliance at the piano. Can you say more about that? I mean, what his playing was like?
He had a real gift for bringing out the contrapuntal layers within a piece of music so that you could actually hear it with remarkable clarity. And I think that's something that comes out most in his Bach playing.
But there was also something else about him, his eccentricities, his, you know, fear of catching a cold, of being cold. He wore gloves and coats in the summer. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a famously eccentric figure. He once, and this story that I'll just tell briefly, I think touches on a way in which his eccentricity really still captures the imagination, not only in its strangeness and weirdness, but as a kind of window onto a person with a very rich internal life. And that was when he was playing once with the Israel Philharmonic, and apparently he was playing a series of concerts, 8 or 9 concerts of Beethoven, and he had to play on what he said was the worst piano that he had ever had to play on. By the 4th or 5th concert, it was absolutely driving him crazy. What he did was he drove out to some sand dunes outside of Tel Aviv, and he just stared at the sea, and he reconnected with the memory of his old Chickering piano, and he claims he actually, in his mind, performed Beethoven's 2nd concerto the way it should feel. Apparently gave, you know, the most brilliant performance of the entire run.
Well, you know, some have said that, especially coupled with the fact that he left the concert stage at such a young age, 31, that he had this eccentric behavior, which you can hear in a lot of his recordings, you know, the hypochondria and all of that, that maybe, you know, you speak of an internal life, maybe he had more of an internal life than an ability to have an external life, that as much as he could communicate with music, he might have had a very difficult time communicating with people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at least in conventional terms, you know, even while he was famously hermetic and stayed up all night and slept during the day, this sort of thing, he was also famous for calling up his friends and associates and talking their ear off for hours at a time. That was just one of these paradoxical aspects of his appeal, I think, is that on the one hand, he was very reclusive, and yet on the other hand, he had this undeniable urge to communicate.
He also, as you write, might have been onto something, technology. He had technology that he could go to, and he could record. He could, you know, still do his music and cut the people out of it. In fact, he didn't like the concert goers.
Absolutely, yeah. One of his more provocative comments on an album that was released, he says, "I don't have any concert goers as friends." He had the experience that audiences were just lying in wait for some kind of mistake to transpire on stage, and the life of a touring virtuoso was absolutely not for him. He thought that it stymied his creative impulse, that it breeded a conservatism of repertoire, and that it was absolutely inimical to all things he associated with artistic life.
But he loved the technology.
He loved the technology. The recording studio in a way, freedom from social contact. He referred to it as a womb-like atmosphere. It enabled him to, in a sense, take one step closer to reaching that creative state where he could really experiment with different ways of playing things and search for the ideal version. And for him, it was one step closer to being a creative figure.
Do you remember when you first heard him?
Yeah, I heard him first when I was a teenager and really getting bitten by the bug of classical music for the first time in a very serious way. The first contact I had with his playing, it seemed to encapsulate all of the qualities that got me so excited about classical music at that age. There was a kind of joyful spontaneity to it. There was this expressive exuberance. There was a kind of life-affirming quality to and sense of joy that really struck me at the time.
Jeremy Eichler, it's been over 25 years since Glenn Gould died. Do you think 25 years from now and 25 years from then, he'll remain that enduring?
I would certainly not be surprised if he were still around at those points. Some of the impulses that he captures in his playing and some of the deep emotions that he taps in his responses to this repertoire are absolutely timeless, and I'm sure will be enjoyed for many years to come.
That's Jeremy Eichler, classical music critic for the Boston Globe here in Boston, Massachusetts. Jeremy, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.